It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
When a bridge is closed to bring people together over food, you're witnessing a metaphor coming alive. In Sacramento, the Tower Bridge Dinner over the Sacramento River, in front of the capital of California, over 800 guests are served a dinner celebrating the annual Farm to Fork Festival. A team of chefs, over 1,000 volunteers, and local farmers bring their best to the bridge for a delicious dining experience that earns mutual respect and gratitude. I'm on that bridge to talk to chefs, farmers, and guests, and first, I'm glad to catch the CEO of Visit Sacramento, Mike Testa.
The attendance goes up every year. We've seen that since the first year. That first year, we hoped for about 20,000 people, and last year, we got about 140,000 people, and we equally matched that yesterday, if not a little more. So the interest continues to grow. People continue to show up and support what we're doing, and I think Farm to Fork has been embraced by this entire region.
You know, one thing I hear this year, that there's more people from outside the region that are finding their way here, yeah. and media that have heard about it that have come here this year to look it over.
Yeah, I think that's the luxury of 7 years. It's not a well-kept secret anymore, and we certainly have had national interest from media. We'll have 6 national media representatives sitting on the bridge this evening, so certainly that helps to tell the story in future years. And our job as a visitors bureau is to bring people from the outside, so we've been fairly successful that way.
Well, your job is to keep everybody excited about this thing too, keep it on track, and you got it on track now. You've got how many volunteers are there helping here over the bridge?
Over the weekend, there are more than 1,400 volunteers that help.
It's just incredible.
On the bridge, there's a couple hundred that help. So yeah, we've got a database of 4,500 volunteers. They are incredibly valuable. We could not do this without them. So we hope that the attendees have a great experience. We also hope that the chefs feel rewarded for doing this. This is our first time having an all-female lead chef team. We've brought in someone from San Francisco, I think, has been very impressed with our region. And, we want everybody to feel a sense of accomplishment. When we started Farm to Fork, it was not just about the White Linen restaurants. It is about everybody in this community, whether you eat in high-end restaurants, whether you eat a pizza on a Friday night. Everybody lives Farm to Fork in Sacramento, and I think we've seen that this year especially.
Well, I think everybody's proud of what you and your team are doing, so thanks so much for what you're doing for Farm to Fork. Keep up the good work. Enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, we're on the bridge, and we're talking to Pat Prager, and Pat's the executive chef of the Sawyer Hotel, one of the newest hotels here in Sacramento, and it's a great one. It's right by the new arena. Now, you're here on the bridge. What are you fixing for an appetizer tonight?
So we did everything local. We got we have a partnership with Lano Seco. It's a pig farm here locally. So we got a suckling pig. We cooked it whole, sous vide. We shredded the meat. We made a rillette. So we added a little bit of bacon fat, creme fraiche, some pickled mustard seeds. That goes on a house-made cracker. We have peach chips, stone fruit puree, and a little bit of pickled cherry tomatoes on there. So it's kind of like end of summer pate awesomeness.
It looks wonderful. It looks beautiful right now, and you got all the crowd ready to come in. So
right.
When it's almost over, I'm going to come back and grab one if there's any left.
Please do.
One more quick thing, though, I wanted to add. So you're the new hotel. You're a prime spot in town, and you've got all kinds of things going on, but one, you even have your own garden. Can you explain that?
I do. So on the fifth floor, we have our own rooftop garden. This past season, we planted heirloom tomatoes and peppers and a bunch of eggplants, squash, melons, herbs, flowers, edible flowers, that sort of thing. So it's really been kind of a fun, passionate project for me. And then we use a lot of that produce to kind of supplement what we already buy locally. It's been a fun project, and we also have a beehive up there.
A beehive, too.
Yeah.
Almost everything. Molly Hawks, you were one of the chefs at the Bridge Dinner, and it went great. My opinion was it looked great. Yeah, they were over 800 people. How does it feel to have that behind you, and what do you think about that experience?
I'm thrilled with the way everything went, and I'm, in particular, I'm just elated that we pulled our dish off successfully. That was tricky it was kind of risky to try and plate that pasta individually for over 800 people. So I'm just so happy it all worked out.
You got to describe that dish then.
So we had a pasta course, and the whole theme of the every course on the dinner had an Italian. It was an Italian themed dinner, and so we wanted to work in pasta, and in trying to figure out how to best work in a pasta course for over 800 people, plated individually, we came up with the idea of taking little aluminum cups and lining them with many slices of roasted eggplant, and then we filled them with the pasta. It was a pasta shells and a beautiful heirloom tomato sauce with green zucchini, yellow zucchini capers, and a little, you know, Calabrian chili in there as well.
And something was on the plate too that they sat on top of. What was that?
Yeah, the sauce was it was basically a traditional pesto, minus the pine nuts, so it would take care of some of the allergies out there. So just a beautiful basil pureed with olive oil, Parmesan cheese. That's it.
Well, it was perfect. I mean, it was about the size of a cupcake. I mean, maybe a little larger.
Yes.
And it sat right in the middle of the plate. Beautiful plating presentation. And I'm not used to even thinking about that, but when you try to plate for 800 and you had these little serving tables up and down the bridge, what were there, like, where the plating was taking place?
There were six stations set up across the bridge, spanning the bridge, and so each station was responsible for, you know, give or take 130 dishes. And so each micro kitchen, if you will, had to individually sauce each plate, and if you know the sauce, as you saw, was plated into a beautiful square on the plate. So there's quite a few steps involved before the pasta could actually go down and the plates could be walked to the tables.
So it was baked where? Away from the bridge and then roll in. But where was it all?
Yeah. Where did you cook it? So if you back up to the Monday before the bridge dinner, we received 300 pounds of heirloom tomatoes at our restaurant Hawks in Granite Bay. And we're closed on Monday, so we made the sauce on Monday because we needed a lot of space and to get that rolling. And then beginning Wednesday, all the chefs met at Golden One Center in Sacramento, and they were so kind to allow us to take over their big kitchens to do all the prep work. They just have all, you know, when you go to 800 people, you need bigger equipment to make everything happen and lots of space, and they have everything you could possibly need. So we prepped there Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday actually, and then Saturday evening everything got packed up in refrigerated trucks. Or I should say got ready to pack up. Sunday morning, everything got packed up and hauled off to the commissary kitchen, which was set up on the West Sacramento side of the bridge.
And really, from the center, it wasn't a half mile or so, but you still had to move it in refrigerated trucks over to that other side.
Yes.
So before you hit the weekend, you already had them all, they were... Well, it was hot, wasn't it?
Yes.
Hot. So when did it get
hot? So we did all of the heavy lifting, all the assembly at the Golden One Center, finishing up Saturday evening just as they were trying to get us out and have everything packed up into these carts. And then on Sunday, they got baked off and reheated basically just prior to serving on the bridge. So it was, we had a few test batches. You never know how the rental equipment in the commissary kitchen is going to, you know, how it's going to react, and every, you know, ovens are all calibrated differently. So we had several testers to make sure that we got just the right temperature and the right amount of time so that we could pull this off. Because if we cooked the pasta cups too long, they were caramelizing on the bottom and they wouldn't come out of the cups. And if you didn't get, you know, even... Conversely, if you didn't heat it long enough,
can I volunteer to be one of those tasters?
Sure.
You want to sample them the next time around? Because I'm going to say this several times because I thought it was absolutely delicious. I really loved it. And so you go out to the six stations. You've got it ready to serve. You got these long, long tables all across the bridge that was over 800 some, and you had the six stations. And at each station, then somebody is opening them up. And who supervises the plating in each of those stations to make sure it's going on the plate just exactly the way that you want?
So there was a chef assigned to each of the six stations, and they in turn had two sous chefs and then cooks or commis station below them, so that there was a, you know, kind of a hierarchy at each of the six stations. And it was really up to the chefs to key in on the plating during the lineup we did in the commissary kitchen. And then it was their job to make sure that the plating, that all the dishes were plated correctly. And
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, so in our case, our dish was able to, we were able to put the sauce on the plates in advance of laying down the pasta. So we were able to paint the basil, the pesto on in that beautiful square, and then put the garnish down on the plates, the compressed zucchini strips, as well as the roasted heirloom cherry tomatoes.
So at each one of those stations, then they're doing like a serving like 120 people each for each one of those stations.
Yes.
And they're managing to get them all delivered and set down pretty close. I mean, they're to have that many servers to be able to so quickly get everybody get a plate in front of them, about 120 that these stations looking after, that's quite a job too.
It's a tremendous undertaking, and you don't realize till you're out there on the bridge how that's one of the things I really love about this event is everyone volunteers their time for this. And so for the community, for all of us, you know, the chef community and the restaurant community to come together and volunteer their time to pull this off and do it so seamlessly is really, you know, it makes you realize you're someplace special.
Well, were the servers volunteers too?
I believe so.
Mm. And there was, and so were many of them experienced in wait staff around town that were volunteering for a night off or something to be working on the bridge?
Yeah, I believe that the sommelier team, the servers, and I know that Morgan, our general manager here at Hawks Public House, he volunteered his time to come do it just because he wanted to be a part of the dinner.
I met somebody that had been involved in here years ago and was now living in Indianapolis and came back just to help with this.
Oh my goodness.
And they bought a plane ticket to come back and volunteer.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Volunteer their time. Well, after it was over, I mean, you took particular interest in that particular course. What kind of feedback were you getting? Were you, you know, people saying that's really tastes great, or were you able to kind of fish for saying, well, what if we're going to do it again, would we have done it a little differently? What was the feedback you got after the fact?
As a chef, you always ask those questions, right? You're always evaluating, how could I do it better next time, or if I were to do it over again? But the feedback we got on the dish was great. It was very favorable. And, you know, we received some nice emails, too, and follow-up just from guests that we knew who were in attendance at the dinner. So
the products that you went into, you were saying you got the heirloom tomatoes in at your restaurant in Granite Bay, that you started working on that to be able to you know, get the sauce, the tomato sauce put together just right. Was it a local farmer that provided those heirloom tomatoes?
Yes, the tomatoes for the sauce came from Landerosa Farms in Vacaville, and Landy, I honestly don't know his last name, but Landy, the farmer there, he actually just, he just wandered and found us here at the restaurant one day and brought in some beautiful tomatoes, and, you know, that's oftentimes what happens, and that's what I love about having so much agriculture in this area is we get these farmers who will just come visit us. They think they, you know, if they've got a cool product, they know that we'll be interested in. They'll just show up and bring some samples, and we'll, you know, oftentimes establish a relationship and start using their products.
And the eggplant, was that local?
The eggplant came from Full Belly Farms in in Cape Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an interesting story too, because initially we were going to try and source the eggplant from Hillview Farms, which is a small farm in Auburn. And they, we did all of our test batches with them and had been in communication with them, but you never know what's going to happen on a farm. And they ended up, just as the season was changing, they ended up not being able to fulfill the order that we needed just because their yields were diminishing on their crops. Likewise, their squash had been infected with the aphid outbreak, I guess. So they ended up having to pull all of their squash plants. And so we were, you know, calling on other friends at the last minute to try and figure out where we're going to source everything locally. But that's, it's one of the challenges when you're dealing with such great volume of product. Luckily, our friends at Full Belly were came through with us, and the everything they provided was amazing.
Well, and they do a great job. And
yes.
They're down here supplying people in Sacramento all the time. And,
yes.
And been up there myself, and it's great. So all of that's come together, and it's behind you now, and you know, looking back on that experience, how do you feel about going forward? I mean, did you have some feelings about, okay, that was great, and have you identified some things that you think that maybe we can do different or something that we ought to consider adding when we go forward with the Farm to Fork activities in the future?
I think that, I'm very pleased with the way the dinner rolled out this year, and I think incorporating, like this year was a new challenge to plate a dish, you know, bring out plates that were individually plated, like our pasta course. I think it's important that we keep adding elements or pushing ourselves as chefs to improve the dinner every year. Another area where I think we can maybe see some improvement or just add another element is with the farmers. I had several farmers come up to me after the dinner saying that they eagerly want to be, they want to participate more. And, you know, they want to be able to make that connection on the bridge between the farmers and the chefs.
So, you know what? I had some of those conversations, too, and I wondered about that, if there could be almost like a farmer table. And one of the farmers recommended to me that maybe they have a table that's some empty chairs and people could take turns going up there and sitting down and chatting with the farmer and asking them questions directly about some of the product they're contributing or just something to kind of get a little more interaction going on.
Yeah, and I think there might be a perception that sometimes that the farmers don't want to be, you know, put out front and center. But after seeing the event and how successfully it's pulled off, I believe that they do want that attention, and it's important to drive that connection as well. So I think that that's feedback I'm happy to provide, or if there's a way I can be involved with that, I will.
You know, I'm sure you know other people that are chefs in restaurants around the country, not necessarily just here in Sacramento. Is anyone else doing this sort of thing that you're familiar with?
You know, I haven't heard of a dinner like this on a bridge. I'm sure, you know, perhaps they do happen, but, you know, you hear of other large events like the Dinner en Blanc, and but I haven't heard of quite of anything of this magnitude.
You know, I heard that you had a competition the same weekend of the bridge, which was actually in New York City, in Manhattan on Bryant Park. The New York Times was involved in promoting a food festival, and they had identified, I think, like 20-some chefs. And then on the Sunday paper, the same day as the bridge dinner, the Sunday New York Times had lengthy stories about each of these chefs. And each of the chefs were interviewed, had a nice picture of them, asked them where they're going to get ideas and things like that. But you know, one of the things I found missing in that entire section, there was no mention of the farmers.
Interesting.
And I thought, you know, here you've got two festivals you've got going on the same weekend, Manhattan and Sacramento, and that's kind of telling. I'm sure that some of them appreciated the farmers, but it was not something they brought forward, that their relationship and that connection,
right,
as much as you do here in Sacramento.
Yeah, and perhaps because we're so intimately connected with the farming community here, it's, you know, our farmers here, you know, they'll grow things for us. You know, we have relationships where they'll ask us before they're planting, and, you know, we'll kind of direct the quantities and items that we need for the upcoming season. So it's, you know, I think it's part of what makes this area so special.
Well, I tell you, chefs like yourself make it special, too. You care about that sort of thing, and you're, you know, there's a certain kind of humility in that. People aren't all full of themselves, that they're working together and they see themselves as teams, as the farmers and the chefs, and the big winners are consumers like I am oftentimes. But congratulations.
Thank you. It was
wonderful, and I wish you would offer that dish that you made. I come to your restaurant just to buy that. So
thank you so much. You might just see it on the menu.
I hope so. Okay, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Of course.
The stories on the bridge dinner went to the chefs, but also went back to the farms. And one that was particularly interesting, I felt, had to do with cherries. that didn't have a home when they first were on the trees in June and were preserved and used in a special dish. And I'm happy to welcome Hinnia Eilers McIntyre, and we're going to tell the story of the cherries, Hinnia.
Well, actually, it's a sad story that had a fun ending. So we grow about 20 acres of organic Bing cherries in Linden, California. And this year, as many crops were, the crop was very, very late due to weather, due to the rains, just lots of different factors. And our cherries, we were picking. We were excited. They looked great. We were not hit by those late rains, though a lot of the Linden area cherries were. And ours were okay because they were still green. And when it came time to pick, we were 3 days into picking, and we were stopped short at 12 noon on a Sunday and told, "We don't have anywhere to sell your cherries. The market for California Bings is closed." And it was a shock. We had great-looking fruit. It wasn't the best year. They were a little smaller, and our pack-out was about 60%, which isn't terrible. But it's worth picking for us. But we couldn't. We had nowhere to send them. And our processor was closing down. And so we pulled everyone off the ladders. We closed down, and we had to sit there and look at 20 acres of trees. At this point, probably only 15% of the field had been picked. So the rest of the field was going to sit there and just rot, which is a terrible situation.
Yeah, it sounds terrible. Let me stop you for just a second and ask you something. So when somebody lets you know the market is over, does that come from somebody that's purchasing or a supermarket chain? How does that word get communicated that okay, we're switching over to Washington cherries and we can no longer take any cherries from California? Who do you get the word from when things like that happen?
Well, the company that produces, that means they wash and package all of our cherries, also represents Washington. And so they have a vested interest in both. And I don't want to get too political with that, but it's a tricky spot to be in when you're a California farmer that's coming in with a late crop, because your fruit is good, but it's not wanted because the next batch is on time.
How long does the season last? And when you start picking cherries until you're through with your cherries, how long do you have to harvest the cherries?
Well, we have another 15 acres of conventional cherries as well. So combined, we usually pick and have everything out of the field in the course of 11 days.
And wow, that is short.
It is. And if there's pending rain and we can get enough pickers, we can do it in as little as 6.
So you're faced with having most of your cherries left on the trees and no market. And that's where I interrupted you. Now, kind of continue with that story of scratching your head and saying, we're facing this. What do we do? What did you do?
Well, it was devastating and it was sad. And we've had crops, be destroyed by rain, and that's devastating in a different way, but you can't do anything with it. But here's beautiful fruit. And we know that there's hundreds and thousands of consumers that would love to have it, but they don't even know that it's sitting a few miles from their grocery stores, a few miles from their restaurants, and they don't get access to it. And so I invited a whole bunch of friends, families, to come pick. Just get these off the tree, enjoy, give them to your neighbors, make friends. Let's just try to enjoy these cherries. And I was walking through the field with a good friend named Eric Werner, and he has been a sous chef up in Auburn at Carpe Vino, and he has connections there, and now he's a coffee roaster. And he was saying, what do you think about seeing if some of the restaurants want these cherries? And I said, well, that would be great, but how do we get them to them? And do you think they'd want them? And what would we, how would we do this? And so we just started walking and talking and literally eating fruit off the tree. And, you know, when two people get together and have passion and excitement, and things just started to evolve. And he said, well, I'm going to start using social media to tell the story, if you don't mind. So he started sharing the story and asking who wanted them. And then we just started picking. And I brought other friends out to just pick as many boxes as we could and started bringing them around to different restaurants. And the more he started to tell me, okay, this now, you know, Baker and Cake Maker in Auburn would like some, and Mike Fagoni at Hawks would like some, and Eric Burton at Wise Villa would like some, I started to think, I have some connections too. I know some people. So I brought a beautiful box to Brad Seshi, and over the course of enjoying some wine in his living room and talking about cherries and talking about their restaurant and what how markets work, he said, you know, I think we could, how big do you want this to go? I think we could get these in a lot of different hands.
And we should introduce Brad. I mean, Brad is, he's one of our rock star chefs here in Sacramento. And he said, has Cannon, which hasn't been open too long. It's just fantastic. And he's worked in, before he came to Sacramento, he was in a restaurant that had a Michelin star.
Right. So it was a super exciting connection to bring him some cherries. And then he knew Allison Harvey from Ella, and he got me in touch with Allison. And Allison is just a phenomenal, authentic person who responded right away and said, I'm going to bring some people, and we're going to come out and pick cherries. And I met her probably 2 days later in the field. We picked cherries together, and she put them on the menu at Ella. And then she called a few days after that and said, could I come get some more? And could we put them in the Bridge dinner? And that was the most exciting call of all, of course. I said, sure, we'll meet you there. And she handpicked herself probably about 200 pounds, maybe 300 pounds of cherries. But my question was, Allison, this is June. How are we going to put cherries on the menu in September? And of course, with skills like Allison's, she instantly knew how she was going to preserve them. And I'm not going to share all her secrets, but she sent me some pictures and told me what she did and told me her ideas. And then the rest is history. You got to taste them, and we got to taste them on Sunday night.
Well, and it was in, what would you call it? It made it into a sauce of sorts, or... What would you describe the cherries that were put on the sturgeon as part of the Bridge dinner, which, again, we've talked about often? Over 800 people came to the Bridge dinner, and this course had your cherries included that were harvested in June. But is it a sauce, or what do we call that?
Yeah, it's almost like a chutney. But if you remember the theme and the desire of the head chef this year was to keep the food as authentic tasting and original as possible and keep it very simple, which is what also was alluring about how was she going to prepare these cherries without altering them. And so I would say they were pitted, they were chopped, and they were almost like a chutney without a sauce, and they were hidden under the shaved sturgeon that was smoked also over cherry wood, which is a really cool addition. And then it was all kind of packed on a small bed of beet, I believe. Remember that mm-hmm. pink kind mm-hmm. of blanket underneath? Yeah.
Well, it was just incredible. And so, you know, you pulled it off. They tried it. Do you think that now that this has been tried and you've been able to have some of this product that was harvested in June and still be, you know, fabulous at an event that, you know, 3 months later, is there potential to create a product that helps extend the cherry season by having some some way to either kind of, you know, preserve or put into a form like this that could be used for other restaurants or anyone that wants to really do an interesting job with all kinds of products like Sturgeon?
Yeah, I think food is always evolving, and the preparation of food is always evolving. And these chefs are so creative, and they have such a wealth of knowledge in how to extend the life of things, or how they react with certain other foods or alcohols or vinegars and things like that. And so I know that the cherries are living on even right now. We know that they're being brewed and made into cherry sours. I know that Brad has brandied some for some signature drinks at Canon. I think there's a lot of different ways. I think they could be made into preserves, or like what Allison did under the sturgeon. I think it's limitless.
Well, I think it's incredible. And to me, one of the other stories is that you have had experience yourself in managing food companies before, and you have friends that they're in the business, and you were able to reach out to them, but you first had to just make the plunge and say, let's just give it away and get people to try them. And I hate to say the word that it paid off, because I mean, you still had a tough year. But the fact is that it not only got used, but it got used in a way that was delicious, and people come to think of cherries that could be, you know, presented in more ways than just when those first fresh cherries come out that you need to consume in a short period of time, that you found another solution.
Yeah, that kind of is what birthed out of walking through the field with Eric. We started to say, okay, this is a total loss for us economically, right? But maybe we can salvage and bring value by community. We can make connections. We can give this fruit away into the hands of creatives who could do awesome things with cherries, bring awareness to cherries, bring fanfare to cherries, so to speak, in different ways. And we thought, if we hand them out, let's just see what they come up with. And it was fascinating, and also just so encouraging to see each one of the chefs and brewers and bakers come up with things to do with cherries. They could have just all made a cherry pie, but they didn't.
Well, you were standing on the bridge with your dad, John, and watching 800 people be served this after they were plated all up and down the bridge. How'd that feel when you saw your cherries going out to 800 guests?
Well, first of all, I kind of expected there to be a few cherries thrown around on the plate and it to be a garnish of sorts. I did not expect that each person was going to get a serving with probably 3 or 4 heaping tablespoons of cherry preserves. I wish I knew what to even call it.
I know. We got to come up with something.
I know. I guess we should ask Allison, what exactly do you call that? What's the proper term? But that was wild, exciting, just full circle for us. It's been a tough farming year, I'm not going to lie. And I think that just really just filled our cup.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.